It's time for Intersections, where art and science meet, your weekly hour of conversation, where you learn about curious ideas, creative works, and interesting phenomena with your host, Mark Kingsley, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Now, it's time for Intersections, where art and science meet.
I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversations. Today's conversation is going to focus on the camera obscura and other optical instruments that have been used in paintings from the past to the present. We have with us today four special guests. So please welcome Andy Gavran, Associate Professor of Physics in the Department Chair at IUPUI. Welcome back, Andy.
Hi, great to be here as always, Mark.
Thank you. And we have Stefan Petronik, who is the image-based artist and Associate Professor of Photography and Intermedia. I can hardly wait at Heron School of Art. Welcome, Stefan.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here as well.
And I also have Greg Hall, who is the interim dean, and the Valerie Eichmeyer, professor of sculpture at Heron School of Art and Design. Hi, Greg. Welcome back.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me back.
And not last, but we also have Jennifer Lee, who's the associate dean for academic affairs and associate professor of art history at Heron School of Art and Design.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
That's great. So, you know, this topic is so fun because we're looking at optics and light and painting and instrumentation used in the art. And so I think the good place to start would be to understand the role of, I think, of technology and science in art historically. I don't know which one of you wants to grab that one, but historically, how have we used technology in the arts?
I can dive in.
Great.
So I feel like the arts have always incorporated the latest technologies, and there's always been a little resistance to, is that okay? How does that change the game? But I think one of the amazing roles that art plays and artists play is taking those new technologies, making them more accessible, more human, humanizing those, and really digging into them to get past the bells and whistles and find the poetics that are inherent in those technologies. So I think this is, as long as there have been artists, there's been the incorporation of new and emerging technologies.
I completely agree with what Greg just said, but I would also want to point to a specific change in the attitude of the art to technologies that occurred in the time of the Italian Renaissance around the 1400s, because one of the big projects of artists collectively in Italy over the course of the 1400s was reclassifying themselves from the category of craftsperson to the category of intellectual. And so over the 1400s, artists were intentionally incorporating scientific studies and doing scientific experiments and constructing their paintings in a way that showed that they were intellectuals and scholarly and mathematical, because it raised their social status as well.
Well, that's interesting. Andy?
Yeah, I wasn't aware of that. That's interesting to know. I mean, from my perspective, it seems to me that technology has always, whenever there's something new that's possible, artists will grab it and try it out. And I love to see that. And I'm also fascinated by the cases where I think new technology has been motivated by artists, and that could be anything from developing new pigments that painters have used, and that's gone back hundreds, if not thousands of years, to things like the invention of photography, which will eventually bring us to our camera obscura. But, you know, photography, I guess originally the daguerreotype and other early imaging technologies weren't created for science. They were created, I believe, for artistic expression. And then science has adopted those. And I think there are some cases of that as well.
It just makes me think about the notion of you know, this kind of cliche term, but a term that we still throw around, of this like a Renaissance person, a person that's well-rounded and has many capacities as a kind of a both a humanist, someone that can be subjective and relate to feelings and emotions, but also be objective about things through quote unquote scientific lens. So I think artists have always placed, not always perhaps, but I think they're interested in what they can do with whether it be a physical or a visual form. And so they're kind of anything that they can grow that provides a new or a better or more sophisticated means of doing something, they're usually all in for that.
Yeah, I would think that one of the things that makes an artist is choices. In other words, it's the choices of what instruments you use, if whether it be a type of paintbrush or somebody learned to use a palette knife. I mean, different things along the way. But I think it's also where, Stefan, this would be in your area of photography, where what the eye you choose to catch with the eye. In other words, through that lens, you're making choices. You're not just basically setting it up and waiting. You're making a choice as to what is in that field of view.
That's right. I mean, it's all about how you frame your perspective in that way. And so it's like, what are you removing as opposed to what you're adding to a composition? It's very much, when we think about optics, it's all about what are we choosing to remove from our field of view. Because it's a much more, every time we look through a lens, it's a more limited view than when we are looking at the world with both of our eyes.
Yeah, and it also creates, and you could see why, and this will lead us right into the camera obscura, it creates a 2D image as well, which is really interesting. The lens sees something, but what you get on the film or what you get on digital backs now is you're getting a 2D image. Andy, what is a camera obscura?
So a camera obscura, I think the it's a Latin word. It really just means a dark room. And I can't remember where I read this before, but I think the best explanation of it I've read is, imagine that you could go inside a camera and, you know, just be a tiny person in there at the film, looking out the lens. A camera obscura is, it can be small, it can be large enough for many people to get inside. But basically it's a darkened room with either just an open aperture or a lens that allows the light, the whole view of what is outside, to come inside and be projected sometimes on a screen, sometimes on the walls. And there are several, and I would encourage people, listeners, if they're ever in a place where there is one, to go and visit it. My first experience was with a camera obscura in Edinburgh, Scotland, and it's a wonderful thing. It's up on the top of a museum in a little like cupola, and it's up on a hill, so it's got a fantastic view. And you go in there, and they can put about 6 or 8 people, I think, inside. And the screen is a big white curved screen that sits horizontally. And there's an operator who has a handle. And for those of you not on the radio, you can't tell, I'm waving my hands around now. But the guy has this handle and he can control a mirror that brings light from all around 360 degrees in and projects it down onto that screen. And it's just beautiful. It's magical to see the outside world in perfect detail and perfect clarity projected into this white screen on a table in front of you.
Wow. So how did it make its way into artists like Vermeer wanting to use this thing?
Does one of the artists want to take that?
I, I'll take this from a very like non-historian point of view, and just say that I think one of the things that some of the Dutch master painters were interested in is trying to represent the world better, right, and more accurately. Like artists were very, not all artists, but there was a very keen interest, and we see this still today. We really revere artists that have this quite a command of whether it's like working with pencil or working with paintbrush to render a scene highly similar to the way we would view it with our own eyes. And, you know, the Dutch master painters, I think, you know, we're talking in the 1600s, but that Renaissance era, there's no photography there, which became in some ways when it came on the scene in the 19th century, a mechanism for more accurately, and even it's often thought scientifically, I mean, it's called photography of writing with light, that it's much more, it's like this very accurate, almost scientific objective representation. So but we're talking before that type of time. And so painters are increasingly trying to find more sophisticated ways to work with paints in particular to render color, accuracy to render, but also to render representation and linear perspective in the way that our ocular nature is.
That's a really good description. Jen, you want to add anything to that?
I want to add a lot, and I'm trying to decide which parts to jump into. I would completely agree with what Stefan suggested, that artists are striving to become more scientific over the course of the Renaissance and the Baroque period. I think we need to question whether scientific necessarily means objective in the context of painting, because the system of linear perspective is hugely important in the unfolding of painterly history. It has been what marked the difference between a craftsperson and an intellectual artist, between an amateur and a professional. It has been what really set the standard for judging artists over the 1400s, 1500s, and into the 1600s. But the system of linear perspective is one that is itself somewhat artificial. It is a constructed mathematical system that assumes the human observer is immobile, has only one eye, and is seeing in a geometrical plane. Whereas our actual eyes move a lot. We have two of them. Our vision is more blurred and curved at the edge. It does not replicate actual vision. But linear perspective does support the type of vision one gets with the camera obscura. So the camera obscura was a tool that helped artists achieve this somewhat artificial system of organizing the world under the purview of a single human eye.
You know, that's really helpful, because thinking about that really makes a sense that they were trying to construct, right, on two dimensions, something that their eyes, because they have two, binocular vision, they see in three dimensions. And they were trying to, in a way, almost mathematically trick us into thinking we were in those three dimensions, even though we weren't. And so you're right. I mean, they were constructing, right, Jen? I mean, they were constructing this pseudo environment, right? It was supposed to mimic what was real.
Yes, and they're exaggerating it in many cases. If you look at paintings from the 1500s and 1600s, you see a lot of checkerboard floors and exposed roof beams and all these spaces that just invite indulgence in linear perspective and are perfect showcases for proving that you can construct this mathematical system.
Wow.
And I believe Greg was talking earlier about sort of the pushback that happens whenever there's new technology. There was pushback against using the camera obscura to help artists, was there not? I think there were some people that sort of said, oh, you know, this will be the death of art because now anybody can do it, which is of course not true.
I was just going to say that that comment has happened so many times over the ages and continues to this day. I've heard even students say, this is a game changer. This piece of technology changes everything. And, it's probably true in some way. You know, I think artists by nature are curious. And I think that at different points in history, the world's gone through really radical changes. And I think Leonardo da Vinci, you know, if I'm existing in a world with Leonardo, I'm seeing the world through new lens and new lenses. And so I've got to reshape and realign how I think about things. But anyway, I'll get back to your question, Andy. And Jennifer, you may be able to address it more directly with Camera Obscura, just how the community or how artists were maybe questioned or challenged and how they used the Camera Obscura and whether that was art.
You just said how they used it, which is the key question that we really need to be asking, not whether they used it, but what did they do with it when they used it? And there's been a lot of study, especially around the artist Jan Vermeer in the 1660s, who almost certainly used it, but he didn't use it as a crutch. He was not completely using it to construct his spaces. He used it as one of many tools that helped him see. It is most likely. All of these points can be debated. There's a debate, especially around Vermeer, about whether the Camera Obscura is most useful for constructing linear perspective, which he and most artists could probably do quite well without it, or whether it was really useful for studying atmospheric perspective, which is the effects of blurring in the distance and colors being brighter as they're closer to you and more muted farther in the distance. That type of perspective was never tied up in this proof of intellectualism. And yet the Camera Obscura, this scientific implement, may have been more useful for that type of analysis.
Wow, that kind of, you know, Andy, that brings up the idea then, how does either a hole or a lens in a hole, what does it do to light?
Right, well, so the idea of the hole really takes me back to something that's you know, central to photography, and Stefan can probably talk about this more. But one of the great things about a Camera Obscura, because the hole is very small, you have essentially infinite depth of field. When you focus a camera, a regular camera, and anybody who's attempted photography has experienced this many times, you have to focus on something, and the background is blurred if you're focused in the foreground, or the foreground is blurred if you're focused in the background, and you have autofocus cameras now that choose the wrong thing, and it's really annoying. A Camera Obscura doesn't do that. It creates perfect depth of field. So foreground and background are all in focus. The flip side to that, of course, as it is with any camera, is that it's very dim. That's why it has to be a obscura, a dark room. Because if you have a tiny hole with light coming in from a dark place and your eyes aren't adjusted, you won't be able to see anything. So that's really what a Camera Obscura does. It creates an image with perfect depth of field. The lens can change, you know, adding a lens can change how large the image is in your viewing area. What portion of the view outside is actually on a screen, if you've got a screen inside your Camera Obscura. But the hole is the thing that makes the difference. And it should be typically a very small hole. About the rule of thumb is about 1/100th the distance from the hole to the screen should be the diameter of the hole.
And I would just jump in and say, I think one of the truly amazing things about the Camera Obscura, And I think it's compelling just probably maybe even more so today than it was, you know, 1,000 years ago, is the fact that it's just a hole. It's a hole and a dark room, and that creates an image all on its own. And how, when you study that, there are all of these parallels to the way our own eye works. And it sort of unlocks this like really large, interesting conversation about the simplicity of the world, and but at the same time, there are a lot of sort of subtle optical, there's a lot of physics going on in that hole and that dark room, such that the fact that the image is inverted and it's backwards, so any words that would be present outside the camera obscura would be read backwards and upside down. And of course, this opens us up to questions about how we ourselves see the world.
Yeah, the biology is a huge thing, and we should talk about that. But before we go there, I just want to mention again to our radio audience, if you go on Google or the search engine of your choice and search for camera obscura, not only will you find the places that people can go and visit and the tools that artists use, but you'll also find plans for making one room of your house into one. And all you really have to do is seal up one window in a room, cover it with cardboard or aluminum foil or something like that, and then add a small hole, maybe a quarter of an inch or an eighth of an inch or so in diameter. Go in there, turn off all the lights, and as your eyes adjust, you'll start to see the outside world projected on all the walls in that room, as Stefan said, inverted. But quite clear and beautiful. And there are pictures of this online that you can go and see where people have done this in their room.
And it would have to be really light outside, right? Because gathering is, you wouldn't do this at night.
No, exactly. You need to do it. You do it on a bright sunny day and it's dark in your room and you can see the bright sunny day projected on all the walls inside your dark room.
That's true. Yep, we've done it and played with the aperture size. I would say don't make a hole in the cardboard. Use some different size holes and try different things, because you'll see as the hole gets bigger, the image gets brighter, but there's more diffraction, around the edges gets blurrier. But it is amazing. I mean, it lets you understand that light is being bounced off objects and being transmitted out into space and into the space we exist in, and our eye is capturing this. And it's kind of amazing.
Greg, Jen, go ahead.
The fact that light bounces off objects and is transmitted into our eyes was in part discovered through experiments with this exact sort of technology. There was a long-running debate that started back with Aristotle, and it was still an active debate at the time of the invention of linear perspective in the 15th century. But the question was whether your eye worked by sending out little particles, they called them species, that would kind of sense the world, almost like your eye had a little feeler ray that was cone-shaped and ejected from the eye. This was called the extromission theory. And the opposite theory was intromission, where these little particles or species would come off the world and into your eye. And both of these had huge implications for the role of people in the world. If things are coming into your eye, then whatever you look at is being assimilated into you and could potentially transform you. And if things are radiating out from your eye to sense the world, then you have a huge influence on the world that you experience. And these were big debates in medieval theology, and optics was tied up in the study of theology. The Arab scholars were the leaders in exploring all of these topics. Europeans got into it in the 12th century when Arabic scholarship started to be translated into Latin. But the camera obscura, by bringing light through this hole and projecting it onto a screen or a wall, it meant the image was being formed not with the human eye. The image is formed on the wall without the participation of the human. So this says, it's not extra mission. It's not us making the image. It's the image being made and we can receive it. So it kind of moved the human a little out of the center of the universe to understand that vision worked through light and not just from our brains.
Yeah, I think, Jen, that's a wonderful description. The idea that you have something where there was actually a debate whether you were emitting some sort of something onto something to illuminate it, coming from within the being, because that was human-centered, or whether it was coming back. Camera obscura certainly started to prove that it was external to him. That's a great description. We've been talking about optical phenomena, the camera obscura, pinholes, flipped images, and painting. Please join us for more conversations after this break.
Hi, this is Tony Morris. Join me for an hour of some of the best music for guitar on Classical Guitar Alive. Each week we explore a wide variety of music with guitar, and you'll also hear interviews with many of the world's foremost performers and composers. That's each week on Classical Guitar Alive.
Saturday mornings at 5 on WICR The Diamond.
We are strong, we are resilient, and we will get through this together. But these are stressful times, and it's important to also practice good self-care. It's normal to feel overwhelmed, anxious, or afraid, but there is hope. Reach out to someone, connect with your friends, stay in touch with your community, and know that you are not alone. Learn more at wearebroadcasters.com/hope, furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Kiesling, and today we're having a conversation about optical instruments in painting with Andy Gavrin, Stefan Petronic, Greg Hall, and Jennifer Lee. And when we left for our break, we were talking about really interesting stuff, Jen, whether light came out of the eyes to illuminate something or whether it was coming back from something in the camera obscura really looked at that. You all alluded to earlier, though, that the eye sees like it has a lens, it really does have a lens and it sees like that. What are some of the weird things that the eye does connected to our brain when we're seeing things?
Oh boy, there's so many. I mean, the one that I think Greg already mentioned, and I'll just make it a little more specific, is that the image that the lens in your eye creates on your retina, the light sensitive portion in the back of your eye, is in fact inverted. It's upside down. And your brain is a fabulous image processing engine that fixes that in some sense and gives you a right side up view of the world. And there have been experiments done where people wear goggles that re-invert the image in front of them. And for the first few hours or days, they need to be led around. They can't do anything. I mean, they can barely feed themselves. They certainly can't walk. They're looking at an upside down world. And after some period of time, the brain makes the correction and reinverts the world. And then if you take the goggles off that person, they have to readjust again to normal vision. And I'll leave it at that, but there are other things as well that maybe somebody else wants to pick up.
I was always sort of intrigued by peripheral vision, like the vision that's just out at the edge of your vision, and trying to sort of focus on that without turning to look at it, because then it's moved. But just thinking about the impact that that has on us, and came to realize through trial and error and through research that it has a lot to do with just our stability. You know, the horizon line in my peripheral vision helps me understand where I am. And if I can start to play with that horizon line, I can disrupt your experience enough to make you stumble. And so it is interesting how much information is actually being brought in and being processed. And we're aware of a small portion of that, but just millions of pieces of information that we're processing every moment as we collect not just visual data, but every other sense as well.
When you think about a lens, it's trying to replicate, you know, what happens somewhat in the eye, and we have a lot of ability to move that lens through muscles and all kinds of things. We're able to actually reconfigure it in certain ways. We squint, we can do things with the muscle, eye muscles. But Stefan, how has that idea of a lens in the eye moved into the world of cameras?
Well, there's a lot of technology built into modern camera lenses, even the relatively small lenses that are in your mobile phone today. You know, one of the things that you're right, that a lot of like optical design is predicated on, or we at least look at the model of our eye as a basis, I think, of a starting point. Although Andy might be able to correct me because he's much more knowledgeable. I know very little about the construction of actual optics. But one thing that originally, like when in the 19th century, in the era of kind of the invention of photography, we had pretty simplistic lenses, mostly convex lenses that would do some kind of simple focusing into these like camera obscura like devices, which were, you know, core of camera obscura was these small kind of mobile boxes. We can think of a camera obscura as a whole room, but we can also think of it as a pinhole viewer as well, right? It's just a darkened chamber in which an image is formed on some type of screen. And so these mobile kind of camera obscuras that some of the painters would use in order to make sketches in the field, so to speak, those are the early cameras. It was just from there a pretty short hop in from an invention standpoint into finding some mechanism to record what our eye sees on that screen, but to record it permanently through a chemical process. And so I'm getting a little bit away from lenses, but we started with very simplistic type of lenses. But there were increasing sophistication. And one of the things that lenses can do that our own eyes cannot is that they can have different focal lengths. So the focal length of our eyes are set based on how much the distance is from the lens of our, or the front or the pupil of our eye to the back of our eye, because that's the focal distance in effect. But with the lens, we can construct a different lens that has a larger distance that where the image falls. So that creates this ability to have a zoom lens. Now, zoom lens is a little bit even more sophisticated than just a different focal length, but it implies that you can shift the focal lengths to your liking to zoom in and closer to a subject or further away. One of the things that photographers spend a lot of time in is the subtlety of how optics changes the way a two-dimensional rendering of a three-dimensional space looks. So if I give you a 50 millimeter focal length lens and I ask you to take a picture of a person or take a portrait, and then I say, now do the same thing, but here use this 18 millimeter lens, the results of the way that two-dimensional rendering looks of the person is quite different. And the 18 millimeter lens is actually a very wide angle lens, and it distorts the perception of depth in a way that we're not accustomed to with our own eyes.
Yeah, hence they call some of those fish eyes, right? I mean, because the idea that you could look sort of way back in the periphery behind you, which is unsettling sometimes. When you actually see a photo that way, it's funny. I think as a person that looks at pictures, I'm more able to look at something where I'm zooming in. When you pull way back, that's a really strange view sometimes. Warps everything in terms of that. Jen, what's interesting to me is this idea that we made this transition somewhere along the way from representing by the physical hand of creating it into that idea of photography, which became its own art form in and of itself. And how did that affect the world of painting, I guess, or did it?
I think it did, because when you can replicate the world through technology, then the work of painting no longer needs to be that replication of the world. In fact, we've got plenty of reality. Now we can make more copies of it. It becomes up to the painters to do something beyond just make a picture of the world that looks real. And that even began before photography. To go back to Vermeer just briefly, he didn't just record and create very realistic looking Dutch interiors. They're very carefully constructed so that the light comes in and illuminates just the most significant items in the room and sets an emotional tone. But later in the late 19th century and early 20th century, when photography is becoming a dominant method of recording the appearance of the world around us, I don't think it's coincidence that this is the same time when abstraction becomes the primary project of painters, because they're kind of freed of the burden of replication and expression becomes more important.
And you think that's because they might have been able to see the world differently through a hole or a lens that began to change their perspective, and then they thought they could intentionally do that. So instead of representing the world as it what really was, they could play with it.
And maybe had to in order to continue to have a unique and crucial role. I mean, we can argue about whether artists ever were fully engaged in recording the world as it was.
Right.
But it certainly was one of their goals for many years, and there was an easier way to do it. So arts were, in a sense, liberated to manipulate that world more and perhaps capture some of the non-visual aspects, like the effect of the world on the human.
Yeah, just to jump in real quick, a very common phrase that's echoed, at least among, like, kind of in art classes sometimes, is around the time, once the invention of photography officially happened, we kind of focus it around 1839, because that's when Fox Talbot and Daguerre, two people in two different places, kind of came up with slightly different methods for fixing an image. But the saying is painting is dead. And really what that meant was, well, there's this other form. It's a lot actually easier to represent the world. And we can fix the world's likeness through this photographic chemical process now. So what are we going to do as painters? What are we going to do as artists? Like, this notion of trying to perfect representation through the hand, from a philosophical standpoint, there was all of a sudden a big juggernaut, you know, and so you can look at it as a something where it really opened up and expanded, but it was also, I think, from an artistic standpoint, it was like, well, what do we do now? So that just might be...
I'd love to follow up with a question for any of you on that subject. It seems to me, just as an outsider, that probably the area of painting that would have been the hardest hit would have been portraiture, which was very important at that time. And then, you know, now all of a sudden anybody can get the family picture done and you don't have to sit for long. Maybe a few seconds instead of a few hours at best, and maybe not even that long. What was the effect on portraiture in particular?
Interesting. I don't know if we have a portraiture person here, but Jennifer, can you field that?
I don't have a complete answer, but I would say on one level, it meant that more people had access to portraiture. You didn't have to be that high elite person who could hire a painter and sit and have that painter work on your portrait for weeks or months or however long it would take. So it became much more accessible. It probably put a number of professional portrait painters out of business. I don't have any statistics on that, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
It also would have made two registers of portraiture. So the traditional method that would still be associated with high class patrons. And we still see that.
Yeah.
We when people are really important, somebody paints their portrait. For everybody else, we have photography. So there is that stratification of portraiture, a wider use of it. So it didn't kill it, but it did transform it.
No, and that's really interesting, because part of what's inherent in there are a couple things. One, you mentioned the idea of people who are pretty famous or usually fairly wealthy or of power. They get things like the Obamas had stuff
and thinking about that.
Done. I mean that, and then I think about the other side of it is that we now have access, which is a wonderful thing for me as an artist. I have access to reference images. And artists were doing that before by doing little sketches when they were on site and then coming back to, you know, where they had the full studio to work. This must have revolutionized the ability of an artist to have an image from somewhere else. That they could bring back that was the, you know, that had that looked like that. Is that true?
I would think so. I would allow you to, you know, it shrinks the world in a way. You could get photographs from other places, places you hadn't even been to. But there's also a danger in working directly from the photograph. There's a difference between working from a live source and from a photograph. So some of those debates would continue. I think the demise of painting was greatly exaggerated. And I do think that notion that photography democratized the portrait is an interesting idea. I think about the cell phone now, and everyone is a photojournalist. And so, you know, making these tools even more accessible and making them even more available, letting us all sort of participate in capturing the world around us.
It also means that portraits are harder to idealize. If I were hiring a portrait painter in 1700, I'm going to hire one who's going to make me look better than I ever really did. But that's harder to do with photography.
Truth in photography.
Yeah, until I get to Photoshop, and then I can do something else. But that's true. And, you know, I'm thinking, I really do think about what you were saying, Greg, a lot. And that's that it's weird, but we seem now to have apps to take and turn something back into a painting that's a photograph, which is so that it looks like a portrait that was painted. It's just bizarre. I mean, we kind of went through one hole and back in another.
Photoshop, that's probably the longest single menu that you can open in Photoshop is all the artistic things.
Yeah, all the things that you can do to, you know, to touch up things or to do things. It's amazing. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversations that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others any of the ideas we're exploring today in today's show, and we'll be right back.
Join us for the University of Indianapolis Faculty Artists Series on Saturday afternoons at 2:00. Host Michael Toulouse brings you his fine commentary as we showcase faculty and visiting artists performing exceptional concerts and recitals from the Crystal DeHaan Fine Arts Center on the University of Indianapolis campus. That's the University of Indianapolis Faculty Artist Series, Saturdays at 2 p.m. on 88.7 WICR.
There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19. This message brought to you by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
Music. Dave Baghdad, host of The Kitchen Party Kaylee. I hope you'll join me every Sunday at 10 p.m. for the best music from Ireland, Scotland, Canada, and the U.S. The Kitchen Party Kaylee, Celtic music from across the globe and across town.
Welcome back. We're having a conversation about the camera obscura and other devices used in painting. And Andy, I'm always really fascinated by the idea that we have to use drawings in physics often to represent how rays move through a lens. And I always found the drawings to be somewhat useful, but really confusing at the same time. Can you help me with that?
Yeah, those are what we call ray tracing diagrams. And once you get used to them, they're extremely useful. And in fact, we have now sophisticated programs to do ray tracing to design. This is that thing Stefan was talking about earlier, to design fancy modern lenses. A typical camera lens might have anywhere from 10 to 20 individual lenses all stacked up inside it. And those are designed by ray tracing. But those ray tracing diagrams are actually very confusing, and they often give a misleading impression about how lenses actually work. So as an example, they often show sort of rays, a ray that comes in from the sort of into the top part of the lens and a ray that comes in the middle. And it creates some sort of image behind the lens. And it can give the impression that if you were to remove the top half of the lens, that half of the image would disappear. But that's not in fact what happens. And we sometimes do in class a demonstration where we set up a lens and create an image. And then if you've got money, you actually break the lens and put half of it back where the whole lens used to be, and it still creates the whole image, just a little blurrier and dimmer. And that's not at all what that sketch would seem to imply.
I was thinking about the fact that the lens is just a vehicle to show what's really there. And so take away half the lens, the thing that was there is still there. And so, I don't know, I was thinking about, you know, perspective drawing that I'd done, sort of different ways of projecting form into space. I was also thinking of the term relative to contemporary practices. Ray tracing is a term that's used in computer graphics as well, and mm-hmm. a way that talks about sort of managing light and how, rather than light, pixels would bounce off virtual objects in a computer space. I find it interesting that language continues into a new domain now.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that leads us kind of into that idea of virtual reality, right? I mean, that we can now produce something in 3D. We don't any longer. I think I was amazed once when there was an application that came out on the very first devices that you could wear and do that you could actually do a 3D painting. You could paint out in space, which was really, really intriguing to me that you could do that with both your hands. So it was fully tactile. It was very interesting. Where are we with this now?
So you can paint and sculpt and do many things now in those virtual spaces. And one of the things a student actually just recently told me, that rather than having to learn the software to do 3D modeling, if you can play a video game, you can sculpt and paint and create in a virtual space and then bring it back into real space using 3D printing. I think the thing that I find most engaging is it's so fully immersive. You're in that space, you're brain really quickly understands where it is in response to those. And you can't avoid getting out of the way if something appears to be coming at you. And I think it's interesting to think about how it sort of plays with your perception. And it is so fully immersive because it is a wraparound experience. I think it's interesting that we're not only using that to create and experience things, but it's becoming a tool in our art history classrooms. I think that's really exciting that it's being employed in those spaces.
Yeah,
it's being used for reconstructing lost works of art or putting things back together that have been perhaps separated in museums on different continents. We can reconstitute a sculpture. We can put reliefs back on ancient Roman buildings and our eyes perceive them as though we are seeing them in their original state.
Yeah, it's interesting to me. I saw an exhibition called the Leonardo Experience in London. And it was amazing because they were able to take exactly what you were saying, Jen, and reconstruct it in the building, because it's not in the building, doesn't exist. Parts of it were out. They were able to put it all back together. And it wasn't 3D immersive, but they were able to pop back in what it might have really looked like in that space. It was incredibly useful to get the scale and all that, what the original might have been like. So I think it's wonderful when we think about documenting for art history, using modern technology to look backward to understand something. It's amazing.
It really is. And similarly, you can look forward. The ability to create virtual spaces, you can now start thinking about creating a building that you might build, or a space that you might create. Greg was talking about 3D printing a minute ago, and that's a fabulous technology. And there are now 3D printers available that are really, quite inexpensive, less expensive than an average priced digital camera, that can start to print models that are, large enough to make things like your own chess pieces, for instance. And they're out there in the public, and people can experiment with these things now. You can create furniture, you can create all kinds of things.
I hear some of the same concerns. These are game changers. You don't have to be an artist now to make these things. And maybe all it's doing is proving the concept that everyone is an artist. Make it available, and it's ultimately what you do with it and how you use it as a vehicle to communicate or engage. And so I think some of that sense of wonder that existed the first time you get to see an image generated through a camera obscura, it's something just amazing about it that is held in that space. It's something very magical about that, and I think that sense of wonder has attracted artists and attracted audiences forever. And I think that continues through these new technologies as well.
I do. And I think there's something amazing about something human about us that we want to get in that space. We start talking about the camera obscura, that somebody could stand and be a little tiny inside something. And I do think that's a very human quality to imagine what would it be like to be immersed in another world. But now we can actually imagine that other world and put ourselves in there, which is pretty amazing. Were you about to say something?
Not really, other than just that we really have amazing amount of choices as artists, but as just creative thinkers to experiment and express ourselves in, when you think about the vast means. And I don't know that necessarily like a virtual reality experience or sculpting in three dimensions in a VR with a headset on is necessarily any more satisfying or better than working with alabaster and working much more directly with your hands. But it gives us different types of experiences, and it allows us to better question, I think, the world around us, which is ultimately kind of where this nexus of artistry and science kind of meet, right? About like trying to better understand the world and reacting to it as human beings and kind of pondering and being conscious. So we're, in that sense, we have so many toys in the toy box to express ourselves with and to think about. It's really fantastic. We're quite fortunate.
Yeah, it throws us into this thought about, you've got so many different ideas going here, but that idea that artists really can help with perspective. And that's honestly true, Andy, in science. So that's one of the, besides the creativity that both artists and science express, there is the idea of a change of perspective.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a way of looking at the world. Science, I think there's a lot of different ways of describing what is science, just as there are a myriad ways of describing what is art. But I think in both cases, how you look at the world is really a central thing. It's not about the equipment. It's not about the papers or the even the experimental designs or any of those details. It's about exploring the world, looking for a kind of truth. And again, there's probably more than one kind of truth that appeals to different people. But the truth that scientists look for and the truth that artists look for is a valuable kind, and a kind that I think we like to share. Scientists and artists, particularly those who also choose to teach, really want to share that perspective, that way of viewing the world that they have developed. And that they share perhaps with a professional community. And I hope that shows like this can be part of that, can be part of expressing our ways of viewing the world to a broader audience.
Well said. That leads us to, you know, to being people who want to be more curious. And I really do think that's what art is all about, is not only the artist being curious, but invoking that also that curious perspective in others. And this has been really wonderful. I want to thank Andy Gavron and Stefan Petronik, Greg Hall, and Jennifer Lee for helping us explore the amazing world of optics through art and technology. You'll find pictures of their projects and those of other guests on the Da Vinci Pursuit website at thedavincipursuit.com. where we create museums without walls, so artists, scientists, and the community can come together to enjoy unique activities and conversations. Until then, I'm Mark Kiesling reminding you, tune in again next week when we explore more curiosities from the intersections of art and science.
You've been listening to Intersections, where art and science meet, with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversation that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others. Any of the ideas explored in today's show at www.thedavincipursuit.com.